This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the midst of a hard-fought presidential campaign, a second electoral battle is also raging across the United States, this one to determine which party will control Congress in 2017. New Hampshire is once again in the thick of the political mix, with several of the most closely watched congressional races in the country. Republican incumbent Sally Kelly Ayotte and Congressman Frank Ginta will face contested party primaries in September. The Democratic slate of candidates, including Governor Maggie Hassan in her first U.S. Senate bid, former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter seeking to reclaim her seat, and Congresswoman Annie Custer is already set for the fall election. All the candidates will grapple with complex and contentious legislative issues, including terrorism, immigration, gun control, and Supreme Court appointments. Today on The Exchange, we take a closer look at the 2016 congressional elections in the Granite State. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me for the show this morning. With me in studio is Dante Scala. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of New Hampshire and co-author of the book, The Four Faces of the Republican Party. Dante, it's good to see you.
Good morning, Dean.
And joining us a bit later in the show will be James Pindle. James is a political reporter covering the 2016 presidential election for the Boston Globe. And Dante, let's start with an overview of what is at stake in this election in terms of party control. Your sense of whether one or both of the chambers of Congress are vulnerable to flipping party control this time around.
Right. So Republicans right now control both the House and the Senate. Republicans hold 54 seats in the Senate and 247 in the House. And up until now, the conventional wisdom has been that the U.S. Senate in particular could be up for grabs. And there are about a half a dozen seats held by Republicans right now, which could be considered toss-ups, 50-50s. And Kelly Ayotte's seat here in New Hampshire is one of those six. So if Democrats can essentially run the table, win five of those six, hold Harry Reid's seat out in Nevada, as well as the Senate seat out in Colorado, they could control a Senate majority come January.
The terrain for Democrats seems to be a little bit more favorable this time than in 2014, when it seems like those Senate races were fought mainly on Republican terrain.
Exactly. And this, you know, this goes in six-year cycles, right? So remember back to 2010, that election, when Kelly Ayotte won her seat, that was Barack Obama's first midterm election, and it proved to be disastrous for the Democrats, Republicans. And so that's what – it all comes around, right? So
right.
Republicans win lots of seats in an off-year election, but then that means lots of seats that they control are up for grabs 6 years later when there might be more favorable political environment for the other party.
So Senate – Democrats have a shot of regaining that. What about the House of Representatives?
That's certainly more of a lift for the Democrats. I mean, right now, Republicans have about a 30-seat majority. So that's a lot of seats to flip in order for the Democrats to control the House, even by the narrowest of margins. But we take a look at Donald Trump's presidential campaign since he wrapped up the nomination at the beginning of May. And we look at not just the firing of Corey Lewandowski, Trump's longtime campaign manager, is really just the icing on the cake. And it's been a rough 2 months. Right now, Donald Trump, according to the latest federal election campaign reports, has just $1.3 million cash on hand, which sounds like a lot. It's $1 million. But compare that, Annie Custer, the Democratic incumbent in the 2nd Congressional District here in New Hampshire, has $1.7 million. Yeah. So Trump's at a big disadvantage. Hillary Clinton right now has more than $40 million cash on hand.
Well, and I saw a statistic that at this time in 2012, Mitt Romney literally had $20 or $30 million more just raised way ahead of Trump in terms of fundraising.
Yeah, back in 2012, Obama-Romney was much more closely matched. Mm-hmm. Right now, all the traditional metrics by which we measure a presidential campaign, money, staffing, polling, all is going in Hillary Clinton's direction. So now, is there time for that to change? Yes, but could we say it's been a wasted 2 months for the Trump campaign, which wrapped things up at the beginning of May? I think there's good evidence of that. And so what does that mean down ticket here in New Hampshire and elsewhere?
Right.
Unless things change for the Trump campaign, you know, who's going to be – there's not going to be much help at the top of the ticket for congressional candidates on the Republican side here in New Hampshire and perhaps elsewhere. And if the bottom falls out from the Republicans, then it's possible that the House could flip, although that's clearly a much heavier lift than the Senate.
Yeah, one of the things that political scientists often talk about is the impact of redistricting and gerrymandering and the fact that there just aren't that many competitive seats in the House anymore.
Right. And so there's – you know, Democrats have to do an awfully good job of basically winning every seat that's a toss-up or even tilting in a Republican direction because of the makeup of the House, because Democratic voters aren't allocated very efficiently. That is, they tend to be congregated, clumped in urban areas, whereas Republican voters are more spread out. But all that said, things are breaking about as well for the Democrats right now in terms of their congressional hopes as they could be in terms of the overall national political environment.
Mm-hmm. So given the dynamics of the House of Representatives, the fact that we're hearing some Republican elites actually worried about potentially losing a good margin in the House or an outside chance of even losing control of the House, that should be seen as a sign that there's a lot of concern about the Trump campaign.
Absolutely. A lot of concern. And also, I mean, there are a lot of Republican elites with money who are sitting on the sidelines looking at Donald Trump and shaking their heads. No, no, we're not going to invest in Trump's campaign. Let him do it himself. He's wealthy enough.
Well, he has said he'd be happy to. He said the other day he's happy to spend his own money. We'll see.
But will those elites then turn their attention to the Senate and to the House to protect a Republican majority against what they might see as the near certainty of a Hillary Clinton presidency?
Yeah, so fund the other races rather than give the money to Trump. I want to tell listeners we're talking about the 2016 congressional races here in New Hampshire and around the country. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. Maybe you're following the U.S. Senate race in here with Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan, or we also may have questions about your particular congressional district here in New Hampshire. So, Dante, we've talked a little bit about what's at stake here in terms of party control. Let's look at the other side of the coin and talk about voters. We've talked about politicians. Let's talk a little bit about voters. There are some significant differences in how voters in New Hampshire behave between presidential election years and congressional years. Say a little bit about those differences as you see them.
Yeah, they're two quite different universes of voters in presidential election years versus midterm years. We've seen this happening for a decade. I mean, New Hampshire is a so-called swing state, and it really swings the most in those off-year elections when fewer voters turn out, and typically one side or the other does a better job of turning out their vote. So you have big Democratic years, or more recently in 10 and in 14 to some extent, good Republican years. Mm-hmm. But in presidential election years, you have a bigger universe of voters. You get more voters who vote less frequently. That is, they might turn out every 4 years instead of diligently every 2 years or even for those local elections. So you have a bigger universe of voters. You get more younger voters, more infrequent voters, less wealthy voters. All of that tends to favor the Democrats. And so what we've seen really since John Kerry beat George Bush back in 2004 is New Hampshire's a swing state in presidential election years, but it has a persistent tilt to it, maybe a percentage point, give or take. So if you have, in other words, if you have a 50-50 election nationwide, then New Hampshire is probably going to break 51% to 49% in favor of the Democrat. And that's how things have been now for a good decade.
Well, it's stark if you look at who voted in 2008 here in New Hampshire with President Obama's first victory. And then you look at that Tea Party revolt in 2010. I think your colleague Andy Smith has said just fundamentally different electorates showing up at the polls in the state.
Yeah, New Hampshire is just – there's not enough of a margin of error for either of the major parties to – survive a wave election very well. And so that, again, is an additional alarm for New Hampshire Republicans if they can't stoke their base to turn out in this election, which has been so controversial on their side because of Donald Trump. So Kelly Ayotte, right, whoever the congressional candidates are in the first and second, they've got to be very strong campaigns in terms of get out the vote because they don't know what to expect of anything from the presidential campaign in right. terms of turnout.
Right. Now, you've talked a bit about Donald Trump and the impact that he's having among Republicans and the concern about turnout for the down ballot races. What about Hillary Clinton? You know, here we are in New Hampshire. She lost the New Hampshire primary by a significant margin. She has high unfavorabilities in every poll, not quite as high as Donald Trump, but very high for a presumptive nominee. What are the concerns for Democratic down ticket candidates here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, Clinton certainly has her set of challenges, and one of them is what will Bernie Sanders voters do? The ones who propelled him to a huge win in New Hampshire last winter in the primary. And that's especially true for two groups of voters. I'd say young voters, maybe first-time voters who turned out for Bernie Sanders. There wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton among young voters, a clear generation gap in terms of Clinton's supporters and Bernie's. And then second, independent voters. And I'm sure there's some overlap between those two, but people who aren't necessarily wedded to the Democratic Party. They turned out for Sanders because they liked his message, because it was an anti-establishment message. Will they be enthusiastic enough for Clinton, or will they be worried enough about Donald Trump that they'll actually show up to vote a second time this year in November? So those are her chief challenges, I'd say, going into the general election campaign.
Well, it's interesting. She seems like she's had a lot more success in getting kind of party regulars and sort of the establishment in the state, all the key legislative and statewide office holders to really stick with her and defend her. Even as she had this difficult run in the primary here. So, you know, Maggie Hassan has been quite strong at supporting her. A number of the other elected officials have as well. So it seems a little bit different than the Trump situation.
Yeah, and we know that the Democratic organization is going to be ready to go. It'll be fully staffed and so forth. And so if there are votes to be had, they're going to get those people out to vote. But those two groups in particular, young voters, independents, are going to be a key test for Clinton and of course, then down ticket. Because if, let's say, Bernie Sanders can, you know, comes to New Hampshire, heartily endorses Hillary Clinton, stages rallies and so forth, then that should have a down ticket effect. Because those Bernie Sanders voters, if they turn out for Hillary Clinton, chances are they're going to be Maggie Hassan voters, not Kelly Ayotte voters, mm-hmm. if they, you know, if indeed they vote down ticket.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about split ticket voting here in New Hampshire. Is it something we typically see? I know you can't. I don't think you can punch a single button anymore to straight ticket vote. But likely to see some of that this time around.
There'll be some of that, I imagine. But there's here, as elsewhere throughout the nation, there's a lot less split ticket voting than there used to be, and so that makes the presidential election even more important for the congressional candidates because it's become increasingly difficult in a polarized country where Democrats vote for Democrats and Republicans vote for Republicans, and people don't see that overlap that they used to see. Well, you know, he's a Democrat, but he's a conservative Democrat, or she's a Republican, but she's a liberal Republican. People don't see it that way anymore. So it's it's difficult for congressional candidates on either side to outrun the top of the ticket by a significant degree, especially if they're faced with a reasonably serious challenger.
We're talking about the New Hampshire congressional races today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can post on our Facebook page. I'm in studio with Dante Scala from UNH, and we'll be joined in a few moments by James Pindle of the Boston Globe. Dante, I have an email here from Nathan in Cornish Flat, and it kind of gets to our discussion of the field in general. And Nathan's concern is with the Democratic Party here in New Hampshire. He says there's sort of no challenger to Annie Custer in the 2nd Congressional District, that in general the DNC should have done more to get candidates on the primary ballots. What's your sense of how the party has moved forward on this in terms of trying to recruit others, or do you not typically recruit others when you have a sitting incumbent?
As a rule, New Hampshire Republicans seem a lot more enthusiastic about intra-party primaries, aside from the presidential, but for congressional and so forth. New Hampshire Republicans tend to have more contested primaries than New Hampshire Democrats do. So I think my guess is there was a wish within the party to congregate and support the incumbents, and to gather behind one challenger, whether it's Maggie Hassan or Carol Shea Porter, who was an incumbent. But I think there was—
And who now is in the 1st Congressional District running to take her seat back, essentially unopposed.
Essentially unopposed. Yeah. And so you don't typically see the National Party get too involved with setting up the candidates for the local congressional races. Probably have to go back a decade or so, back to 2006, when the National Party tried to intervene against Carol Shea Porter's opponent in the Democratic primaries. And Shea Porter, who was then a relatively little-known grassroots activist, soundly thrashed the so-called establishment candidate with the backing of the National Party. So the National Parties tend to take their cues from locals about getting involved in those sorts of intra-party primaries.
And Nathan, thanks for that email. Just a couple minutes before we have to take a break, but let's start shifting gears here and talking about the specific races. And let's start with the Republican primary for U.S. Senate. The incumbent Kelly Ayotte running to be elected to a second term. How is that primary shaping up?
We basically have a one-on-one contest. I mean, there are several candidates in the race, but the two that have any sort of name ID are, of course, Senator Ayotte and former New Hampshire State Senator Jim Rubins, who ran for—
It's a couple state offices, right? He's run in the past.
Yeah, yeah, and he ran for in the U.S. Senate primary against Scott Brown and Bob Smith 2 years ago. He's back again to run against Kelly Ayotte. So basically, we have, I think, for all intents and purposes, unless one of the very little known candidates emerges, a one-on-one battle here. It's not seen right now to be as significant a challenge to Kelly Ayotte as was her primary 6 years ago when she was just getting started as a figure in state
politics.
And
that was that was with Bill Binney and Ovid LaMontagne. That was a pretty competitive primary. Well, we need to take a brief break, but lots more on the New Hampshire congressional races and the candidates that are running in those races. And James Pindle will be joining us as well from the Boston Globe. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, the race for U.S. Senate and House seats in New Hampshire. We want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page. In studio with me is Dante Scala. He's an associate professor of political science at UNH. And joining us on the phone now from Boston is James Pindle. He's a political reporter for the Boston Globe. And James, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in the first segment, Dante and I were talking sort of generally about what was at stake in the congressional races this time around, and we've now sort of segued into talking about that U.S. Senate race. So give me your initial thoughts about the Republican primary there. I mean, Dante kind of set it up as Kelly Ayotte versus Jim Rubins, although not really. It doesn't seem like she's likely to lose the nomination there.
Yeah, this really isn't much of a primary challenge right now. You know, Jim Rubins is underfunded, and what you're finding is that Republicans are looking forward to the contest of beating Maggie Hassan. There really isn't a lot of appetite to challenge Kelly Ayotte, except for a very small subset, vocal subset, but a small subset among the conservative base. And, you know, Jim Rubins, by the way, nice guy, clearly, but he is not a perfect ideological fit for that conservative base. He's not some sort of Ted Cruz firebrand. He's much more of a libertarian type of Republican, which doesn't exactly place him. He's pro-choice, for example. I mean, you can go down the line on his positions in the past. He supported cap and trade in terms of environmental policy, which doesn't exactly sit really well with conservatives. He's not the perfect alternative, but right now he's the only alternative for those Republicans who want to protest vote. But right now, that's all it is.
Let's hear a little bit from U.S. Senate candidate Jim Rubins.
We've got two candidates, Hassan and Ayotte, who are both systemically ducking the major issues. They're almost identical to one another in position, so I'm providing an option, an alternative for voters, for a candidate who is willing to confront these major issues.
That is U.S. Senate candidate Jim Rubins talking about himself as an alternative to Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. Dante, one other thing that has been interesting about Jim Rubins is he's actually been a very early and strong endorser of Donald Trump.
Yes, and you know, one of the questions nationwide this year would be, you know, are there Trump-like candidates running for Congress who would be running on a similar set of issues and priorities as Donald Trump? And so far, at least nationwide, we really haven't seen much of that in terms of Trump candidates. Trump has been very little involved in congressional primaries. But we can see Jim Rubins trying to get some traction among a significant group of Republican primary voters. So we've seen him be much more supportive of Donald Trump than Kelly Ayotte, whom we know at this point has said, well, look, I'll vote, you know, I'll support but not endorse. And we've kind of – she's gone through that whole kind of dance back and forth, which we've seen from other candidates as well on the Republican side about what to do about Donald Trump.
Yeah, James, is it counterintuitive to support Donald Trump?
No, I mean, it's opportunistic to support Donald Trump if you're someone like Jim Rubins. Look, I mean, Donald Trump won the New Hampshire primary by 20 points. Kelly Ayotte has had a very tortured relationship with Donald Trump, which I'm sure is something we'll talk about further down the line in the show. Jim Rubins is saying, fine, I support Donald Trump, came out to endorse him about a couple of days before the primary. He released a list of 40 state legislators who are supporting him this morning. So some of those names are Donald Trump supporters. But if you want to go down the line, you know, Jim Rubins is not out there calling for a Muslim ban. He's not out there calling for a wall. He's not out there calling to end free trade policies. So he's not exactly embracing the entire message of Donald Trump, other than the fact that he says that Kelly Ayotte is establishment and he's anti-establishment. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that, but I'm not sure where you go beyond that.
Well, let's talk about Kelly Ayotte specifically in terms of her strategy to win her seat. Dante, one other quick question for you, though, about an independent candidate. Aaron Day is a conservative who I think is running as an independent. Any concerns for her in the general that he's going to siphon off kind of the conservative Tea Party? There is a group of disaffected Republicans in the state who've been very critical of her.
Yeah, Aaron Day is a Free State Project veteran, okay, led the Republican Liberty Caucus. He's declared his intent to be on the ballot, and he's going to need to gather 3,000 signatures in order to qualify for the ballot, which he's got to acquire over the summer. If he does get on the ballot, even if he just gets a couple of percentage points, I mean,
If it's a close race.
If it's a close race, that could make a difference. So I don't think anyone's expecting him to do, you know, to get break double digits or even get beyond 5%. But even if he got that 2%, that could make something of a difference, especially if he latches on to, you know, an unexpectedly strong performance from libertarian candidates, you know, in part because they're looking for alternatives. Like take Gary Johnson, for example, former governor of New Mexico.
Who has a libertarian nomination for president.
Exactly. So if there's some kind of, you know, backlash where conservatives are looking for something other than Republicans to vote for, Aaron Day might benefit. And those surely would be Kelly Ayotte votes, not Maggie Hassan votes.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about Kelly Ayotte, and let's go to the phones. And Dylan is joining us from Durham. Dylan, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
So what I want to talk about was Kelly Ayotte's strategic environmental movements over the past 2 years. Her first 4 years in the Senate were not very progressive at all. And now she's come out against, or standing for the Clean Power Plan, come out with the New Hampshire communities against the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. And I'm wondering if you guys think this is just a strategic campaign move for her to get young voters for 2016, or if this is really how she feels and this is going to be the future of Kelly, a standing Republican environmentalist.
Thanks, Dylan. James, let me turn to you. You can talk about her environmental record if you'd like, but I think Dylan also raises a more an interesting, more general question about, you know, how is she behaving strategically in terms of the position she's taking? I know in recent months we've heard her talk a lot about bipartisanship. We have the votes on the gun control amendments just yesterday. What's your sense of how she's maneuvering here?
Yeah, this is part of the Jed Gregg playbook. I remember when Jed Gregg left the Senate in 2010, he recruited Kelly Ayotte to replace him. And part of the Jed Gregg playbook was be pretty much down the line Republican and conservative on everything possible, but be a little bit more moderate or progressive when it comes to issues of the environment. That was sort of the way you would achieve your branding that you're, you know, quote, a reasonable politician. And Democrats do the same thing. They concede on certain areas. You're certainly seeing that Maggie Hassan doing that on the Syrian refugee crisis. She is not taking the Democratic line on that. She's trying to show that she's a reasonable politician. But in terms of Kelly Ayotte in general, yeah, I mean, there's a difference between a politician, and we see this around the country. She's not an exception or particularly a reason to discuss it, where if she's in cycle, if she's up for reelection within 2 years, votes tend to be a little bit different because they know people are paying attention. You saw this happen yesterday with guns. She voted to prevent those on the terrorist watch list from having access to guns. She was dying to have a sort of a vote like that because she had been such a tortured position when it came to a background check vote a couple of years ago. Yeah, I mean, you're going to find her, now that people are paying more attention, trying to reach out for more bipartisan votes. But the U.S. Senate is still the U.S. Senate. It's a very partisan place, and she has to toe the line for her party.
Yeah, and Dante, I'm interested in your thoughts as well. It was interesting on that on the gun control votes yesterday. Senator Ayotte voted in favor of both the Democratic and Republican amendments on the watch list and the terror list. Senator Shaheen did not. She only voted for the Democratic alternative. Your sense of how she's position taking here in advance of the election?
Yeah, I mean, certainly on that issue, you know, gun control has been an issue that's arisen sporadically during Kelly Ayotte's first term, depending on current events. You know, after the Newtown shooting, for example, there was intense pressure on Kelly Ayotte regarding background checks and so forth. And but then it receded somewhat as an issue. And the usual position on gun control in terms of the opposing sides is that one side is very well organized and the other not so much. You know, the National Rifle Association, very well organized group that makes sure that their voters get out on their particular issue. And so there's a lot of – but whereas on the gun control side, they've never been able to put together the kind of organization that the NRA has. So Ayotte's under a lot of kind of cross pressure. The fact that she doesn't have, at least right now, a formidable primary candidate, you know, gives her a bit of wiggle room. you know, Jim Rubins is trying to press Ayotte on things like immigration. You know, he is calling, he is kind of making that Trumpian call for a wall on the border and saying Ayotte hasn't been as tough on immigration as she said she would be. But unless he gets a louder voice over the summertime, i.e., raises more money and so forth and is able to get his message out, then she's probably got a little more freedom to position herself for the general election.
We're talking about New Hampshire's congressional races today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can post on our Facebook page. I have two guests with me today. James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, is joining us on the line from Boston. And Dante Scala, associate professor of political science at UNH, is here with me in studio. And Dante, you were just talking about Jim Rubins, and we've talked a little bit about his support of Donald Trump. Let's listen to a bit of an Hassan ad that features Kelly Ayotte talking with Chris Cuomo on CNN about Donald Trump.
The Trump speech on foreign policy. Not enough? Too much? What say you?
Well, I have to confess, Chris, I did not listen to it because
what?
I was here doing my work in the Senate.
A clever diversionary tactic by you, Senator.
No diversionary. Lots of work to do here.
That is Kelly Ayotte in an ad by the Hassan campaign. That was an interview with Chris Cuomo where she was asked about Trump's foreign policy speech. James, you could hear the discomfort in her voice.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's dogged to Kelly Ayotte already throughout this campaign. It's going to be even more difficult, I think, heading to the future, where she's got to walk this fine line, right? She Donald Trump is disliked by 70% of Americans. That's a problem. It's a problem for her own reelection. He's at the top of her ticket. So she's someone she's never endorsed. She tried to walk this fine line. At the same time, you know, again, the New Hampshire primary electorate, you know, he won with 36% of the vote. Now, there's a counter argument to that, which is that 64% did not vote for him. But nonetheless, she wants to run her own race, right? She wants to say, I'm Kelly Ayotte, I'm an exception, and in that theory, she's not different than anyone else running for office. Even Maggie Hassan. Maggie Hassan says, don't look at Hillary Clinton, look at me. The problem is, when we talk about these congressional races or U.S. Senate race, the two biggest factors in determining if you're going to win or if you're going to lose is the national mood, and that was stuff that's happening above you that has nothing to do with you. And second is the district you're running or the state you're running in, the electorate that's voting you. So if it's more Democratic or more Republican, then the Democrat or Republican is likely to win. Then we get to other minor factors like who's actually running. Are they raising any money? These things do matter, but they don't matter as much as those first two things. So we've already seen, even in the last 2 months, an environment in which, while even Maggie Hassan and Kelly Ayotte may trade barbs back and forth over certain issues, the defining issues of this race have been the guns and the Orlando massacre. It had nothing to do with anything they've created. It's been unpredictable. The Donald Trump becoming the nominee being a major factor. The Supreme Court having a vacancy. Again, things they don't control. You couldn't put on paper and say, okay, in the third week of June, we're going to do this. These are things that they have to react to. But the overlying environment here, which has been really interesting for Kelly Ayotte, is while Donald Trump appears to be tanking, you know, in the last 3 weeks, you know, this race for U.S. Senate between Hassan and Ayotte has been tied, and it has been tied since the fall. So we're going to wait to see what happens that may go one way or the other, but I expect this race to be tied for a very long time.
Well, and Dante, we should bring Maggie Hassan into the conversation as well. She has her own vulnerabilities to contend with. But first, let's go to the phones. Cheryl from the from Hudson is joining us. Cheryl, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. I love the show, and I wanted to call in with a comment, and I'll try to remain calm.
Okay.
I think it is so absurd that the media and politicians have duped us into playing this stupid strategy game. It's like listening, you know, it's like listening to an announcer call a football game anymore. It's on all the time. And it's not about we elected you, Kelly, or we elected you, Governor Hassan, or we elected whoever we elected, and what are you doing in Washington for the people who elected you? I can't tell you the number of letters and stuff you get in the mail about support me, support your candidate, you know, can you give me some money, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, because you're not done serving your constituents yet. So when you're done serving your constituents, if you do a fine job as a statesman or stateswoman, the American people are going to want you to be back in Washington. And Donald Trump is making a fool out of everyone in this country by saying, look, do you see how ridiculous it's gotten? I can even run for president.
Cheryl, let me jump in there, and I'll turn to you, Dante Scala, a voter who's clearly unhappy with some of the strategic behavior by candidates.
Yeah, and I don't blame Cheryl. I mean, I think a lot of us who observe the politics too, you know, focus on the strategy, handicapping, you know, who's going to win, who's going to lose. And a lot of constituents, you know, people who are going to vote in November, aren't concerned with all the inside baseball sort of thing. They're concerned about what's going to happen to their country. Is it going in the right direction and so forth? I do think candidates are trying to address those concerns, but they do tend to get, I think, a bit obscured by, you know, the national political media and even, you know, the local media, including us, about what, you know, what's important and what's not. It's always worth keeping in mind, I think, that voters inhabit a very different place when it comes to politics than people who follow it every day.
And before we go to break, let's hear a little bit of New Hampshire State Senate President Chuck Morse being critical on Maggie Hassan for her time out of state.
I continue to believe you can't govern from out of state, and you can't mail in press releases like the governor did this weekend and think you're going to satisfy the citizens of the state of New Hampshire.
That is New Hampshire State President Chuck Morse on Maggie Hassan. James, we got a little bit of time before another break. Do you think that's going to get any traction for voters, that argument?
No. Look, you're hearing it from both sides, which is this started with Kelly Ayotte in toeing the line on the Republicans, saying that they're going to have a vote to replace Scalia on the Supreme Court. So Democrats were saying, you know, do your job, Kelly Ayotte, and to other Republicans up for election. And then you saw Republicans put it back onto Maggie Hassan, saying, well, you know, Maggie, you need to do your job. Overall, what's going on here is who gets the benefit of the doubt? Who do you believe in your gut is basically trying to do the right thing? And who's trying to be opportunistic and cute and partisan?
Okay. We need to take one more quick break, but coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the 1st and 2nd congressional districts. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire candidates running for Congress. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find this on Facebook or Twitter. I have two guests with me for the remainder of the show. In studio is Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH. He's also a fellow at UNH's Carsey School of Public Policy. And on the phone from Boston is James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. He's covering the 2016 elections. Gentlemen, we're going to start talking about the two House seats. But first, we have a caller, Glenn from Wolfsboro. Glenn, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to speak to a couple things. One is you had mentioned very early in the show the the partisanship, the high amount of partisanship that has cropped up over the last, say, decade. Certainly, I've been a lifelong Democrat, so I'll mention that right off at the start. Actually, in an earlier day, I could actually vote for a Republican that I like. For example, Warren Rudman. There's a name that'll take you back. I actually voted for him. I used to think that even though I supported Obama, that in 2010, Kelly Ayotte, I liked the job she did in the state, and I thought she might be a reasonable Republican. But it seems like some of these people, once they go to Washington these days, kind of lose their head. And I'm not saying that some Democrats don't do that either, but I think voters are under a misapprehension if they think that, for example, Kelly Ayotte's votes yesterday on the gun bill signify any real change in her position. I think all the experts would say those measures were going to go down in flames anyway, and those are purely political votes that she took, probably allowed by party leadership, knowing full well that those votes were going to go down. So voters should not be under any misapprehension that Kelly Ayotte's had a change of heart when it comes to gun control.
Thanks, Glenn, for that call. Dante Scala seems to be speaking to your comments on split-ticket voting, that the candidates are now sort of too polarized and extreme to really even facilitate the idea of split-ticket voting.
Yeah, although on gun control, I mean, you can see the Senate trying to reach some sort of compromise, and Ayotte is in the middle of it, trying to work out something with Senator Susan Collins, her fellow Republican from Maine. And typically, you know, even though Kelly Ayotte's often described as a moderate because she's a New England Republican, she's actually put together a fairly down the line conservative record, you know, with a few, you know, exceptions on the environment, for example, but probably more conservative than Collins. But we see her and, you know, other Republican senators trying to see, especially on this issue that's become white hot lately, whether there's some sort of compromise to be made on restricting guns to people who might be on the no-fly list, for example, that sort of thing. So I take Glenn's point. I mean, it's really difficult now for partisans who – in good faith look to the other side. They just see the gap between their side and the opposing side to be too wide on most things to take the risk, so to speak, of voting for the other side in hopes that they'll be quote-unquote reasonable, which usually means kind of centrist or moderate.
James Pindle, I want to shift gears and make sure we spend some time talking about congressional district races, Congressional District 1 and Congressional District 2. Let's start with that Republican primary in the first CD. This is incumbent Frank Ginta. There's several people filed, but it seems like his main challenger is businessman Rich Ashew. What's your take on how vulnerable Ginta is in this primary?
I don't think we've ever seen an incumbent politician this is vulnerable ever. I mean, you've seen the polling coming out of the University of New Hampshire where 3 or 4% of even Republicans say that he should be reelected, yet he is still running. Most politicians would look at numbers like that and say, okay, it's time for me to either A, resign, or B, just not run for reelection. He's not doing that. He's all in. He's trying to do it. A lot of people say he's toast because of numbers like that. I'm not there. I think it's unlikely that he wins, but he should lose this Republican primary. But, you know, here's a guy who has won every single Republican, who has won three, you know, separate, the three last Republican primaries, and some of them were real scrappers. And so you have to give him credit for that. This is going to be a low turnout primary. This is going to be a really kind of a trench warfare type of primary that may actually help Frank Ginta in a lot of ways. The challenge, and we're going to talk about this in the second CD as well, second congressional district race as well, the challenge is how do any of these candidates get any attention whatsoever in a presidential year, a presidential year number two that involves Donald Trump, and then also a year that involves open races for governor and particularly probably the country's most competitive U.S. Senate race. So how does Rich Ashew or Frank Ginta, talk about anything at all involving the race? But the race has been defined entirely about Frank Ginta's own problems, his problems with the FEC, his problems that the union leader would call him a liar. He's got some issues there. And so I don't think it's going to be exactly high-minded about fiscal policy. And further, I don't think anyone's even going to know what their differences are on when it comes to policy.
Interesting. Dante, your take on that primary.
Yeah, it's worth keeping reminding listeners how uniquely difficult it is to run for a primary that's held in New Hampshire just after Labor Day. I mean, when we think of primaries in New Hampshire, we always think of the presidential primary. We think very high turnout, lots of national attention. This is just
it's like mid-September. It's the second Tuesday in September, I think.
This is just the opposite, right? I mean, candidates campaign all summer when no one really wants to pay attention to much of anything, let alone politics. And it all builds up to, you know, the day after Labor Day, voters wake up to the fact that the kids are going back to school and that if you're a especially devoted partisan, you have to go vote in about a week or so. And then it's this big rush to the end.
Maybe watch a debate or two.
Maybe, yeah, if you're especially diligent. And so that's the difficulty for all of these candidates. And, I mean, one advantage that both Ginta and Ashu have is at least they're somewhat well – I mean, Ginta, of course, is well known to the voters of his district. That could be to his detriment, as James pointed out. But Rich Ashu has appeared on the ballot before. He ran in the Republican primary for this very seat 6 years ago against Frank Ginta
Former BAE executive?
Ashu's a former BAE executive, also worked for UNH as director of the Rudman Center. And so this is his second try for office.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Rich Ashu talking about foreign policy recently.
Something's not working. The nature of the problems, and I'll go to the national security one, that is a priority to me in a way that I don't see it being a priority really to many others. Failure of leadership in Syria. We've basically taken a backseat to Russia in a disastrous Iran deal. Congress should have had more oversight.
So that is Rich Ashu talking about foreign policy. So, Dante, it sounds like what you and James are saying is that it's just going to be a challenge for him to break through, even though he's somewhat known to Republican voters.
I think the thing is that voters in the Republican voters in the first congressional district at this point may simply be looking for a plausible alternative to Congressman Ginta, given his troubles during this term in office. And as long as Ashu can present himself as such, and as long as he has the funds to, you know, get his name ID out there and present himself as a plausible alternative to the incumbent, he's likely to be in good shape. Now, I agree with James. I mean, Ginta is a fighter. He's gotten himself out of predicaments, electorally speaking, that where people counted him out. But this is going to be very difficult unless things change and unless people's views of Ashu become considerably more negative than they are right now.
Now, James, on the Democratic side of the ledger here on the ballot, Carol Shea Porter running for her seat, I believe, for the third time. She won and was in there from, I think, 06 to 2010 and then 12 to 14. Now she's trying to get her seat back. A little bit of unusual politics in that particular race for a while. She was initially challenged by Sean O'Connor, who is now running as an independent. What went on there and sort of what are her chances, do you think?
Well, at this point, it doesn't matter what went on there. What went on there really was Sean O'Connor, this upstart, new first-time candidate, new resident to the state, decided to run, and he had a beef with the Democratic Party and ultimately left it. He tried to drag Carol Shea Porter into it, but she wasn't really she probably played that pretty well. So now she doesn't have an opponent. It's really hard to defeat Carol Shea Porter in a primary. She has won two really competitive primaries in the past, and most people have shied away from it. In fact, there was a moment where I believe it was in 2012 when Washington Democrats, Debbie Wasserman Schultz among them, tried to recruit Maggie Hassan to run against Carol Shea Porter for Congress. And she turned that down because Carol Shea Porter is so hard to defeat in a Democratic primary. Look, this first congressional race, this first congressional seat goes back and forth depending on the national mood, something we talked about earlier in the show. It has gone Democratic in Democratic years and Republican in Republican years. Traditionally, New Hampshire in presidential years lately has gone Democratic. This should look good for Carol Shea Porter. She's certainly going to have the name recognition if she's facing someone like Rich Ashu. And again, it's going to be really hard for anyone to get any attention here. Dante said earlier about the Republican primary, and I'm going to apply it to this one as well. He took the words out of my mouth. It's exactly what I was going to say. Rich Ashu needs to be the sort of palatable alternative. Any person who's running and challenging an incumbent needs to first convince voters to fire that incumbent, and then second, it has to convince voters that they would do it justify enough job. In this case, I think that Rich Ashu says that, you know, Frank Ginta has fired himself and that he needs to be a palatable alternative. But in the case of Carol Shea Porter,
he needs to then fire her as well, and she's not the incumbent in office.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Sean O'Connor explaining why he's decided to run as an independent.
Obviously, I was always my own person, right? I mean, you know, I was not ever a party insider. So I was a Democrat just because I agreed with the Democratic Party on certain issues that were important to me. But some of those issues, fortunately, like same-sex marriage, have pretty much been resolved. I mean, they're completely resolved here. They've been resolved nationally through the Supreme Court. So about a month ago, I started, you know, mulling over this idea. And then as things started happening and I started seeing how things were playing out and, you know, what my real opportunities for a fair primary were, I realized that, you know, being an independent was really who I was.
That was Sean O'Connor explaining why he's running as an independent rather than a Democrat. And Dante, we're running a little bit short on time, but I want to make sure we talk about that second congressional district seat. This is Democratic Congresswoman Annie Custer. I think she's been in for two terms now. Is that right? It's a little bit more of a slightly more Democratic district. Two challengers in the Republican primary, Jack Flanagan, former House Majority Leader, and Jim Lawrence, a businessman who ran in 14. What's your take on how that district is shaping up?
Yeah, certain. It seems to be the least exciting, in part because, you know, Annie Custer is running for now her third term in Congress, and typically incumbents face their chief test, you know, when they're running for re-election for the first time. But Custer's cleared that hurdle. As always, she's been a prodigious fundraiser. She's currently sitting on $1.7 million cash on hand, which is more than Donald Trump's sitting on right now. And on the Republican side, she's facing basically a trio of candidates with experience in the state house as state representatives, Jack Flanagan from Brookline, Jim Lawrence from Hudson, Eric Estevez from Pelham, none of whom are going to be household names to Republicans in the district, although Jim Lawrence ran 2 years ago and did surprisingly well, got about 20% of the vote.
And despite, got in a little late, he said.
Yeah, despite having a pretty underfunded campaign, did pretty well in that primary. So a chief challenge in the second district for those Republicans is just going to be getting name ID out there and building that in terms of the for September.
Let's hear a little bit of Jack Flanagan talking about his accomplishments in state government.
This is what I mean by effectiveness. I'm well respected, I think, in Concord, well enough that I was nominated and appointed majority leader. I think we got a lot of things done statewide. We went from an $8 million rainy day fund to $80 million. We balanced our budgets. We made it easier for companies to stay in the state. We made some changes to Common Core testing.
That is Jack Flanagan, former House Majority Leader, Republican candidate for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District. James, we got just a couple minutes left, but I would love to hear your take on whether or not Annie Custer is at all vulnerable in this race.
I don't think she is, and I think Dante nailed it. This is going to be the least exciting race right now. Again, these candidates are going to have a tough time. These being Republican candidates are going to have a very, very tough time to get anyone to care about this race at all. People who will be voting for the Republican this fall are people who are Republican, period. Is it not like people can break through to say why Annie Custer is particularly a problem beyond the fact that she's simply a Democrat? This is going to be very hard. Remember, Jack Flanagan got in early. He could have had he could have walked his way through the primary. Some people actually did drop out while they were considering running against him. Then he didn't raise any money whatsoever. I think he raised less than $40,000. He's clearly not going to get it done. So then he's having these primary competitors. Again, it's going to be hard for anyone to really pay attention to this primary.
So, Dante, we have about a minute left, but just your overall take here. It really sounds like what James is suggesting is it's just all about kind of competitive turnout and what happens at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, to be sure, it's going to be very – I mean, the second district in particular it's a tough haul for a Republican given
– First CD is a little more Republican.
Yeah, First CD tilts about a percentage point Republican, whereas nowadays – you know, Democrats expect to kind of win their margin of victory in statewide races out of the second congressional district, especially in the Connecticut River Valley, extending from Keene up to Hanover. So Custer has the kind of favorable battlefield advantage, so to speak. But it's going to be, you know, a challenge for all of these Republican congressional candidates. I think James is right when, you know, if this is election turns out to be a referendum on Donald Trump, it's going to be tough for other Republicans, even Kelly Ayotte, perhaps, to get out from under Trump's shadow.
Yeah, and we didn't even talk about the governor's race today. That's another whole show. So be plenty of races for people to watch if they're political junkies and like following this stuff. But we are out of time, and I'd like to thank our guests for joining us today. Hey, James, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
That's James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. He joined us from Boston. And Dante, good to see you today.
You're welcome, Dean. Good to see you.
That's Dante Scala. He's associate professor of political science. He's a fellow at the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire, and he's co-author of the book, The Four Faces of the Republican Party. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org.